Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with just 6 days, no, yes, 6 days before election. What day is it? What week is it? You can get an extra dose of coverage from our weekly podcast, Digesting Politics. Every week, WNYC political director Andrew Bernstein and I discuss the presidential campaign over lunch. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. We'll be recording a new one tomorrow, which might be the second to last one. So sign up for our remaining Digesting Politics podcasts for free at WNYC.org. Now, on the day that the conference board reported that consumer confidence had fallen to the lowest point ever registered in the 41 years since the firm began tracking it. That was yesterday. And when a report came out that housing prices declined almost 17% in August, a steeper decline than even the previous month, why did the stock market soar almost 900 points on that of all days? Should we expect the Dow to crash right away again, or have we reached the bottom? Well, Warren Buffett argues that now is the time to buy, but others think we are still far from the market floor. David Leonhardt, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times, joins us now with the Dow at this moment up 64 points to help make sense of what just happened and what is happening. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
So just talk about yesterday. Before you predict the future, just talk about yesterday first. Why the 11% jump in the face of such bad news and consumer confidence?
Well, I think the first thing is that no one knows, right?
That's always the first thing when we're talking about, right?
That's always the first thing. I got a great email from a reader. You remember the bailout passed and then the market basically tanked for days afterwards, and the reader said, just imagine if the bailout had failed and then the market had done exactly what it did even though the bailout passed. Everyone would have been sitting around saying, look, the market fell because the bailout failed. And I thought that is a wonderful point that really points out just how bad so much stock market commentary is. We don't really know why it moves. We can make some guesses. And I think the guess about yesterday is that despite the bad news, a lot of people felt that the market had already fallen enough. And there were probably some technical reasons as well. There were probably some big buyers of stocks like pension funds that were shifting from bonds into stocks because they'd reached certain levels in terms of how they wanted to be divided between the two. But it's just really hard to know.
Yeah, I mean, you imply in that answer a split between who's really buying stocks and who we think of as buying stocks. It's like these traders go on CNBC every day and say, well, the signs are pointing to this direction or that direction. These are people who are actually in there buying stocks. You would think they know what they're going to do. And so, if they're going to buy, if they're going to sell, that they would really be able to predict. And then it does something else.
Yeah.
But that means it's really somebody else who's doing most of the buying than, our brokers and the people we think of. Isn't that right?
Yeah. And I think that one of the things to keep in mind with the stock market is that over the short term, its movement is unbelievably difficult, if not impossible, to predict, and is mostly meaningless. And over the long term, its movement is highly predictable and very much connected to the performance of the American economy and American companies.
So stocks are down 40% since last October, and history suggests that we shouldn't be surprised that it would start to bounce back. But your column this morning says not so fast.
Right. So it depends what we mean by history. If by history we mean the last 25 years, absolutely. Stocks have now fallen 40%. Every experience we've had over the last 25 years suggests that's enough. They've got to come back. They always do come back. They did actually come back to the highs they had reached, if you don't adjust for inflation. So they even came back to the highs they had reached after the 2000 to 2002 crash. And so that says to us, wow, they must come back. But one of the things that I was trying to argue is that the very fact that they've always come back over the last generation is a reason to think they may not come back now. This has been one of the great bull markets and bubbles in history. And even now, even after this unbelievable decline of 40% over the last year, by a number of measures, stocks are not very cheap. They are about average compared to the corporate earnings or compared to the size of the American economy relative to the last century. They now have a value that's about average. And so what that means is that we shouldn't expect some great bull market over the coming years.
So why are Warren Buffett and John Bogle saying the opposite?
So Warren Buffett, I can't get completely inside of his head, but I think there are a few things worth remembering. One, Warren Buffett gets a much better deal than you and I do. When he invested in Goldman Sachs and General Electric, they guaranteed him at least a 10% annual return. If they were guaranteeing me at least a 10% annual return, I would invest in them as well.
How could they do that? How could they even legally do that?
They can certainly legally do it. They're a private company. They can give him shares that essentially pay 10% dividend. And then they can also say you have some upside depending on what our stock does. And that's how they do it. And why would they do it? Because he was giving them the Warren Buffett name. He wasn't just giving them his money. He was giving them the good housekeeping seal of approval that comes with his name and was sending a message to other investors, wow, Goldman Sachs is okay. And they would then be able to raise additional money beyond the Buffett money. But I don't think that's the only reason he's saying it. I mean, I think in part he may believe it, and I think it's a close call. As I said, stocks are now about average valued compared to history, and so it's possible they'll do fairly well. I think it's also possible they still have a ways to go down.
And for every Warren Buffett, and I mentioned John Bogle, this is not my world. I don't know these guys. I guess he's the founder of the Vanguard Group, right, who argues that return on stocks would still beat out the alternatives if you're looking a little bit down the road. But for every one of them, you can find, as you did, James Melcher, president of Balestra Capital, a New York hedge fund, who said that thinking stocks are cheap is irrational and that stocks could easily fall an additional 20 to 35%. Another third down is, it's almost hard to imagine. That would be back in the 6,000s. When was the last time we saw that?
Probably sometime in the 90s, right? Wasn't it hitting a new 1,000 every couple weeks back in the 90s?
Yeah, I think 6,064 was about the time that Alan Greenspan, ironically enough, first warned of irrational exuberance sometime in the mid-90s.
That's right. Well, Mr. Melcher's argument that we're going to go down more is actually more consistent with history. That doesn't mean it's right, but it's more consistent with history. We've had two other really big bear markets in the last century, in the 1930s, obviously, and the 1970s. And in both those cases, stocks fell to a price-earnings ratio, which is really the fundamental measure of the market, of about 6 or 7. The average price-earnings ratio over the last century is 16, which is basically exactly where we are now.
And what does that price-earnings ratio mean? If a stock is selling for $50 a share,
right,
times 16, that is reflects what?
So if it's divided by 16. Right. So if it's selling for $16 a share, that means it's producing a little bit more than $3 a share of earnings. And there's nothing magical about the number 16. It's just that when you look over the course of history, these patterns are unbelievably striking. What happens is that the price-earnings ratio averages about 16, and it goes in these decade-long waves in which people get extremely optimistic, as they did in the 1920s, as they did in the 1960s, and as they did in the 1980s and 90s, and even for much of this decade. And the price-earnings ratio gets up to 20 and above 20. It even gets above 30, at least it did in the late 20s and in this bull market. And then, inevitably, it turns around. And a big part of the bear argument now is that when it turns around, it doesn't just return to the average value of 16 and stays there. It vastly overshoots because we have a financial crisis, because the optimism turns to pessimism and feeds on itself. And so that if we have fallen to the average now and basically just stay at the average and stock prices now rise along with corporate earnings or fall a little bit with corporate earnings and then start rising, that's certainly possible. It's possible that investors have learned not to get overly pessimistic. But it would also be in some ways unprecedented. We don't have huge bull markets followed by medium bear markets. We have a long, huge bull market followed by a long, huge bear market followed by a long, huge bull market.
In fact, I saw a stat in the Times the other day, maybe you can confirm this for me, that the biggest bear market in the last century, or certainly one of the biggest, was from 1937 to 1942. And that really pulled me up short because you know that the stock market crash happened in 1929. That was 8 years later when, you know, FDR had already been in and instituted all these policies. And then to go to have the biggest bear market, not October of 1929, but that whole long period from 1937, that long after, until World War II started, if that's true, that really indicates the length that these things can take.
Exactly. And I don't have those exact dates in front of me, but they sound right. And in some ways, the right way to think about bear and bull markets is over courses of decades. So basically, we had this great bull market in the 20s. We had this terrible bear market for essentially all of the 30s and 40s. We had this great bull market in the 50s and 60s, this terrible bear market in the 70s, and I'm obviously rounding here. Yeah. It bottomed in 1982. And then this incredible bull market until about 2000, depending how you think of it, in inflation-adjusted terms, it still has not gotten close to its 2000 peak. And so now we're in year, what, 8 or 9 of this bear market, and bear markets usually last longer than that. And this is another thing about your point. The only way we could have had such a bad bear market in 37 was because we had these little mini false bull markets before that. Hmm. You know, who remembers the great stock market rally of 1930 when stocks rose 25%? Not a lot of people, because they almost immediately gave back those gains.
And speaking of which, the Dow is now down 11. So that's how fast it's swinging. Well, last thing then. I mentioned consumer confidence at the top, and this stat from the conference board that consumer confidence had fallen to the lowest point ever registered in the 41 years since that stat has existed. I did see another analyst yesterday saying that's a sign that we've bottomed out, because when consumer confidence bottoms out, then that usually goes along with the bottom of the market. And so things are likely to start coming back after that. How about that as an indicator?
It certainly could be right. I think it's important to have a lot of humility when you're trying to make economic forecasts, because roughly no one is good at it. But here's the big problem with that argument. We are almost certainly still in a recession. No one thinks the recession is on the verge of ending. And typically, consumer confidence does not bottom until well after a recession ends. And that's because pay cuts continue throughout the length of a recession and even beyond. Typically, a recession leads to a 3 to 7% cut in inflation-adjusted income for the typical family, and that cut happens over 2 or 3 years, extending beyond the recession. It happened in the early 90s. It happened in the early 80s. It happened in the early part of this decade. And the easiest way to remember that is that the recession of 1990-91 ended in the summer of 91, and voters kicked George H.W. Bush out of office in November of 1992 because they were still so angry about the economy. So is it possible that consumer confidence in the market are at a bottom? Absolutely. Again, it would be deeply unusual historically.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times, including the one about the Dow and history today. I guess humility and capitalism don't go very well together when things are going up, and then people get astonishingly humbled when things are going down. Huh, David?
Yes, like Alan Greenspan there. Shocked.
And sorry, even sorry.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, the budget deficit for New York State that is now some other numbers that you've probably never heard before, and Governor Patterson's plan for dealing with it at exactly the same time that he has lost his closest aide. We'll talk about it in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.